Bibles that you have at home, dust them off, and read through Job. That would be great. Let's hear Job 3, verse 1 to 26, according to the Message. Then Job broke the silence. He spoke up and he cursed his fate. Obliterate the day I was born. Blank out the night I was conceived. Let it be a black hole in space. May God above forget it ever happened. Erase it from the books. May the day of my birth be buried in deep darkness, shrouded by the fog, swallowed by the night. And the night of my conception, oh, the devil take it. Rip the date off the calendar. Delete it from the almanac. Oh, turn that night into pure nothingness. No sounds of pleasure from that night ever. May those who are good at cursing curse that day. So there's your challenge this week. Unleash the sea beast on it. May its morning stars turn to black cinders, waiting for a daylight that never comes, never once seeing the first light of dawn. And why? Because it released me from my mother's wound into a life with so much trouble. Why didn't I die at birth, my first breath out of the womb, my last? Why were there arms to rock me and breasts for me to drink from? I could be resting in peace right now, asleep forever, feeling no pain, in the company of kings and statesmen in their royal ruins, or with princes resplendent in their gold and silver tombs. Why wasn't I born stillborn and buried with all the babies who never saw the light, where the wicked no longer trouble anyone, and bone-weary people get a long-deserved rest? Prisoners sleep undisturbed, never again to wake up in the bark of the guards. The small and the great are equal in that place, and slaves are free from their masters. Why does God bother giving light to the miserable? Why bother keeping bitter people alive, those who want in the worst way to die and can't, who can imagine anything better than death, who count the day of their death and burial the happiest day of their life? What's the point of life when it doesn't make sense? When God blocks all the roads to meaning. Instead of bread, I get groans for my supper, then leave the table and vomit my anguish. The worst of my fears have come true. What I dreaded the most has happened. My repose is shattered, my peace destroyed. No rest for me ever. Death has invaded my life.
Whoa. See if I can untangle this. There we go. Thank you, Jan, for that reading. How many here know about the Trail of Tears in American history? Okay, good, yeah. Because I want to start this morning with the experience of a young seminary student named Steve Charleston, who back in 1974 had reached a point of deep spiritual crisis. Who he was and where he thought he was heading with his life was threatening to unravel. He had recently read the book by the Native American activist Vin DeLorean entitled God is Red. In this book, Mr. DeLoria cataloged the abuses that the Native peoples had suffered. He described Christianity as a tool of genocide, and he demanded that Native Americans reject the flawed religion of their oppressors. Stephen had arrived at the spiritual crossroads because he had a calling to Christian ministry, and he was a Choctaw. Now, the Choctaw, their experience, unlike many Native peoples, is that they had not had Christianity forced on them. They had invited Christian missionaries to their lands and found the gospel message compelling. Their historic lands took up most of present-day Mississippi and good chunks of the states around there. By the time the federal government began looking for ways to force the Choctaw and others off of their lands to make way for southern planters, the Choctaw were a Christian nation. They had a Christian Bible in their own native language. They sang hymns in Choctaw, and they led their own services. They were also a nation that understood the United States legal system And so they took the federal government to court in order to keep their lands. Their case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which found in favor of the Native Americans and against the federal government's efforts to push them off their lands. President Andrew Jackson, who had counted the Choctaw as allies in the War of 1812, didn't care, however. So he said, in clear violation of the court's ruling, law, and the American Constitution, a military expedition and force marched the Choctaw from Mississippi to the Oklahoma Territory. This death march became known in the history of the Choctaw as the Trail of Tears, the time when their whole world came apart. You know, surely they must have cried to God to deliver them, to save them, and then suffered in confusion when those that died along the trail had to be buried with very little ceremony. I mean, what questions did these righteous and religious people ask when they found that their safe, familiar, and comfortable life had suddenly become threatening, strange, and miserable at the hands of supposedly fellow Christians? I wonder how many of them said, we should just curse God and die. Which brings us to the story of Job. Job, you may recall, was himself a devoutly religious man, living a righteous life, a successful, comfortable, and safe life. And perhaps like the Choctaw, on land given to him by his ancestors. Job's life was exactly the way he wanted it. He just needed to keep doing what he was doing. But when we meet Job in the Bible, he's about to begin his own trail of tears, a journey that would become a cry for answers as to why his life no longer made sense. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, upright, fearing God and turning away from evil. Job chapter 1, verse 1. Written in both prose and poetry, the book of Job is considered to be one of the finest pieces of literature ever written. And while it's one of the most important books of the Bible, the book of Job may be one of the most misunderstood. Frankly, many churchgoers, and pastors for that matter, are not too sure what to do with this strange tale of a completely righteous man beaten down almost to the point of death, while God seems to be okay with making a bet about it with the devil. So it doesn't get explored that often. You do sometimes hear people talking about the patience of Job, which, frankly, I find a little bit laughable, because Job is anything but patient. I mean, read the story and hear how Job rails against the injustice of his circumstances. And they are unjust. How he complains that his friends give worthless advice, and they most certainly do. And how he angrily demands that God show himself, which God eventually does, and explain himself to Job, which God emphatically does not. But is Job even a real person? Is the book of Job history, or is it just parable? And if it's not a true story, is there any reason for us to study it? I think maybe those are some of the questions people have when they come to the book of Job. Unfortunately, like many such questions, these are often not talked about because, well, people on one hand have extremely strong opinions and they're not really interested in dialogue. They may fear questions might undermine their entire belief system or take them someplace intellectually where they're just not prepared to go. Or, as is the case sometimes, they're so sure of their position that they don't see any point in exploring it because nobody but a fool would have another opinion. And on the other hand, the people who actually do have questions are often afraid to ask for fear that one of these strong opinionated folks is going to call them out as either an unbeliever or stupid or both. Yeah, but I often wonder, if we can never safely talk about the questions and doubts among ourselves, how is it that we ever expect to take these stories out into the world? And if we can't do that, how does anyone ever hear the good news? Perhaps that lack of being able to ask questions and seek deeper answers is the reason why some churches are so dead. Life is, after all about questions. But the truth is, when it comes to the historic nature of Job and his story, Nobody really knows. Oh, there's no shortage of people on both sides who claim they do know, but the scholarship remains divided. There's archaeological evidence suggesting Job was a real person, but it's not conclusive. And the book is, as I said, mostly poetry, which seems a very strange way to write history. So parable or history? I tend to think it's probably a mixture of both. But I personally would caution against taking a hard-line position on any of these. Those who feel that Job must be true historical account to be trustworthy and biblical should keep in mind that Jesus frequently taught with parables and stories that the church has always historically understood as unhistorical, such as the Good Samaritan, the unforgiving servant, or the prodigal son. And those who dismiss Job as a real person should keep in mind that for centuries, the scholars dismissed as complete fiction Homer's account of the Trojan War, Plato's description of Atlantis, and even Pliny the Younger's eyewitness account of the volcanic destruction of Pompeii as gross exaggeration. Now, of course, Troy and the site of the battle have actually been excavated. Modern scientists have observed volcanic clouds perfectly fitting Pliny's description, and even recent archaeological evidence suggests that the lost city of Atlantis may indeed have existed, just as Plato described. So perhaps a little humility is in order here. But the main reason not to harden our hearts or minds is because fighting versus exploring together as pilgrims on a journey, these issues, tends to obscure the very nature and purpose of the book of Job. Job is wisdom literature, and as such, it stands with the book of Proverbs. And yet it contrasts sharply with Proverbs to give us a more broader understanding, a richer understanding of what the Bible is trying to tell us. It's meant to tell us something important about this life, our nature, God's nature, and how to approach this journey with God. In the coming weeks, Pastor Jan is going to take us into depth into this important book and explore the wisdom that we can find in his pages. But this morning, I would like to simply look at the book of Job as what it is in its most simple interpretation, the journey of one man who unexpectedly finds himself in the middle of tragedy and becomes desperate for answers. But if you're still hung up on whether or not Job's a real person, then let me refer to you a more modern-day Job, someone whose historical existence is beyond question. C.S. Lewis had been the picture of the confirmed British bachelor until he met Joy Davidman. They were, by all accounts, completely in love. And if anybody could claim to be soulmates, it was these two. But, as with Job, Lewis suddenly found that his world no longer made sense. Because after their brief but profoundly happy time together, a time that Lewis hoped would never end, he lost his wife to cancer. His devastation threatened to completely overwhelm him. Like Job, the life he was living was suddenly blown apart, and the answers he thought he had to life no longer made sense. Like Job, Lewis did not seek to undergo this journey. It wasn't something he chose. It came to him uninvited and in some ways unexpected. To deal with his pain, Lewis wrote it down in journal form. That journal was eventually published under the title A Grief Observed. The book's not very long. It's less than 100 pages. And yet it is so raw and so honest that Lewis was afraid he would derail people's faith because he was already a well-known Christian speaker. And so he originally published it under a false name. So if you really kind of want to get a different perspective on the book of Job, then let me recommend this tiny little book by C.S. Lewis, A Grief Observed. Now, a spiritual journey sometimes begins with a confession of brokenness, a lament or an expression of grief. It's been described as a crying out to God for answers to a life that no longer makes sense. It is a demand for answers, which is exactly what we find in both Job's story and Lewis's story. Now, initially, Job seems to be okay with the terrible things that are happening to him. He just writes them off as God's will. But eventually, that simple religious answer fails him. Job finds himself sitting in a garbage dump, scraping the sores off his body with a broken piece of pottery. He cries out that he wishes he had never been born. Or at least, God would just finish him off right now and get it over with. Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth, and Job said, let the day perish on which I was to be born. And the night which said a boy is conceived, may that day be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Why is light given to him who suffers, and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but there is none? Job chapter 4. Now Lewis never actually finds himself sitting in a garbage dump waiting to die, but he did record this. And no one ever told me about the laziness of grief. It's easy to see why the lonely become untidy, finally dirty and disgusting. I not only live each endless day in grief, but live each day thinking about living each day in grief. Maybe you know somebody in that kind of pain. So the first stop on this journey is to come face to face with the knowledge that you are not who you thought you were, and your life is not going the way you thought it should. So you're forced to question yourself, both who you are and what you believe. See, Lewis, like Job, was a righteous man, a religious man who proclaimed the gospel to far more people than most megachurches ever will. And yet he was forced to come to this conclusion about his Christian faith. He concluded, my house has collapsed at one blow, because it was a house of cards. The faith, which took these things into account, was not faith, but imagination. Many people never come to any real knowledge or belief in God, but for those who do, there will probably come a point where their love of God is only about the things that God does for them or that they hope he'll do. Exactly the charge Satan makes against Job and by extension all of us. You have always put a wall of protection around him and his home and his property. You have made him prosper in everything he does. Look how rich he is. But reach out and take away everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Job chapter 1, verses 10 through 11. Therefore, the first question that the book of Job asks us to face is, who are we really? Are we truly people who love and trust God wherever he takes us, whatever he does or doesn't do? Do we love God, or do we really just love ourselves and look to God to meet our needs and our wants? Have you ever known someone who was truly committed to the Christian faith? Maybe they were a leader, a pastor even, involved in service or ministry, always willing to talk about the joy of God in their lives until tragedy struck and they cursed God and walked away. I have. And God doesn't make it easy either. Not only does he allow tragedy to strike, but then often he seems to go quiet and leave us alone in our pain. Lewis wrote, meanwhile, where is God? Go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that silence, you may as well turn away. Job spends a huge part of his story demanding that God answer for the tragedy that has become Job's life. And up until the very end of the story, God never answers. Job's a very religious man, and he's been doing all the right practices, all the right rituals and observances, and it no longer helps. That old song, give me that old-time religion, well, that old-time religion wasn't working for Job. Lewis felt the same thing, and after much of his life dedicated to explaining and spreading Christianity, he angrily says, don't come talking to me about the consolations of religion. Even Jesus, in his full humanity, cries in pain from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's such a painful, painful cry from our Lord. We don't like to think about it very much at all, or try to explain it away as that it really wasn't real, as though Jesus wasn't really suffering. God just kind of made it look that way. But as with Job and Lewis, the pain and anguish for Jesus is real. And for each of them, religion suddenly seemed not to have any answers. Who am I really? Do I love God with all my heart, mind, and spirit? Or do I just love myself and expect God to get on board my train? So a spiritual journey is about looking for answers to who I truly am, not who I comfortably thought I was. Some choose to undertake this self-examination, but others, like Job, have it forced on them. Either way, we're called to honestly face who we are. A spiritual journey is also about wrestling with and facing the truth of who God really is, and not the neat, clean picture we have created in our mind, the safe and static picture. Pastor and writer Barbara Brown Taylor, in her book, Leaving Church, talked about truly seeking the God that is versus the God we want, and risking the unscripted encounter with the undomesticated God whose name was unpronounceable. So it's been said, we use religion to hide from that God. We prefer God made in our image, one we can tame. If you're convinced that you have never made God into an idol, then ask yourself if you have ever said something to the effect of, I can't believe in a God that. See, we sometimes seem to think that we get to judge God. But the book of Job invites us to face the reality that God is totally free. And the spiritual journey forces us to wrestle with our image of God. Is your image of God one of a nice, safe old gentleman handing out treats to his favorite kids? I think maybe Job had settled on such an image. Until it is, God forced Job to rethink that. See, one of the translations of the name Job is enemy. And Job certainly reaches a point where he feels that he and God have become just that, enemies. Why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? Job 13. His fury burns against me. He counts me as an enemy. Job 19. Behold, he invents pretexts against me. He counts me as his enemy. Job 33. He invents pretexts? See, one way to say pretexts is excuses or made-up reasons. So Job's actually saying that God is making up things to accuse him of because God has counted him as an enemy. Could you believe in a God who makes up reasons to consider somebody an enemy? It has been said, that God doesn't come off looking very good in the book of Job, which makes you wonder how it ever got in the Bible in the first place. Because if you were trying to sell his faith, wouldn't you have left that book out? Lewis also is forced to wrestle with his understanding of God's nature. He asks the question this way. What reason have we, except our own desperate wishes, to believe that God is, by any standard we can conceive, good? Doesn't all the evidence suggest exactly the opposite? What happens to our journey of faith when God doesn't follow our rules, when our concept of the nature of God leaves us shipwrecked and drowning? So if the first thing a spiritual journey demands of us is that we honestly face ourselves, it next demands that we courageously face God as God is, not as we would craft him to be. The book of Job tells us that ultimately God is free. He's not bound by our rules. He isn't called to pass our test in order to be God. He cannot be judged by our standards. As Yahweh told Moses, I am who I am, and I will have mercy on who I will have mercy. And it is how God does finally answer Job. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Job 38. So are we prepared to love God, or would we rather just to continue to judge God by some standard we're comfortable with and dismiss God from our lives when he doesn't measure up, when he doesn't deliver to our satisfaction, when he's no longer following our rules? Lewis and Job never get an answer to their demand to know why God has done this or allowed this to happen to them. God never justifies their pain or grief. But in their spiritual journeys, they both encounter something that proves far more important, far more powerful. Their journeys bring them to a deeper intimacy with God. Lewis says it rather mysteriously, but it speaks to God's faithfulness and love, even when we are drowning in our own pain or sitting among the ashes of what we once thought was the life that would never change. Lewis writes, we are told, and I find I can now believe again, that he has done vicariously whatever can be so done. He replies to our babel, you cannot and you dare not. I could and dared. Job's reply is perhaps a little clearer. He says simply, surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things to wonderful for me to know. Job 42. Too wonderful. Lewis and Job were good religious men. Men who knew the right things, said the right things, and did the right things. They were broken by the things that happened to them. They were forced to wrestle with who they really were. They angrily questioned the very character of God, and they demanded answers. Answers that, in some ways, they never got. Before their journey, they believed they understood what faith in God meant. But as they emerged from their tragedies, they discovered in a way they never imagined that they had at last encountered the untamed God. As Job says, "I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you." They emerged from their journey, their struggle, their own trail of tears, with a deeper faith, a richer joy, and a love of God that was real and not simply self-love in disguise. Which brings us to the final aspect of this journey, and that is perhaps best captured in the words of Jesus himself. "Very truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds." John 12, verse 24. Franciscan monk Richard Rohr, author of The Divine Dance, reminds us that, by and large, what human beings want is resurrection without death, answers without doubt, light without darkness, the conclusion without the process. I mentioned earlier Barbara Brown Taylor, and I like the way she unpacks this truth. For Reverend Taylor writes, "I do not know anyone who likes to fall, but this reluctance signals mistrust of the central truth of the Christian gospel. Life springs from death, not only at the last, but also in the many little deaths along the way. When everything you count on for protection had failed, the divine presence does not fail. The hands are still there, not promising to rescue, not promising to intervene, promising only to hold you no matter how far you fall. Ironically, those who try hardest not to fall learn this later than those who topple more easily. The ones who find their lives are the losers, while the winners come in last. This journey is about being emptied before we can be filled, dying before we can live. And as Jesus shows us, the only way to life with God is through Golgotha, Skull Hill. That is the route of our journey if we would follow Christ. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it." Matthew 16. The cross, gratefully, is not the end of the journey. At the end is the resurrection, into the life of God. But the only way to a life in God is through our own spiritual crucifixion, as we honestly wrestle with who we truly are, as we courageously seek the true face of God, and as we learn to trust that God is with us every step of the way. Our young seminary student did find a way to a deeper Christian faith, and perhaps in the process found an answer to something I think may prove to be redemptive to Christianity in America. His spiritual journey is tied to the story of the journey of his people, the Choctaw survivors of the Trail of Tears, who did something unbelievable upon arriving in Oklahoma. He writes, "Among the first buildings to be erected in the refugee centers of Oklahoma were churches. My great-grandfather was a Presbyterian pastor who was responsible for building several of these churches in Oklahoma. In the churches dotted across southeastern Oklahoma, Choctaws who survived the long walk into exile gathered to pray. They asked God to help them understand what had happened to them. They lifted up their lament to Jesus to help them in their affliction. They sang Choctaw hymns, imagining a better day, a day of justice and redemption." That, then, is the nature of this journey. And that is the story of a man called Job. If the ushers would please come forward.